One of them was found in the Black Forest burned alive. He was burned alive with gasoline poured over him and burned to death.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of Speaking of Security, the cybersecurity and voice security podcast from SecureLogix. I'm talking to Lee Sutterfield, one of the founding fathers of cybersecurity in San Antonio. Today, Lee is telling a story about the early days of fighting internet hackers. It's also the story of how Lee ended up in San Antonio, where he eventually co-founded SecureLogix. But most importantly, it's the story of a moment during the Cold War when one intelligence officer predicts a threat that no one else is paying attention to. One eventually discovered to be a real threat by a computer admin in an academic laboratory in California. Let's let Lee tell the story. How did you first get involved in cybersecurity? You were an intelligence officer in the Air Force in the early 1980s, is that right?
Well, I was in the Air Force for many years as a communications, electronics, telecommunications focused technician level person. They sent me to university for a while for an electrical engineering degree. And my first assignment as a communications officer was at an organization known as the Foreign Technology Division, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. And the mission there was to prevent technological surprise. Mm. I was assigned there in 83 as science and technology intelligence officer was the title. Mm-hmm. And what that really meant was I was kind of a technical geek who was supposed to write about stuff in the intelligence world.
Intelligence geek. I like that. During that time, as I understand it, you wrote an intelligence paper outlining a new kind of intelligence threat that no one was paying attention to?
I wrote a paper in 84, late 84, that was published. The unclassified title of the paper was The Exploitation of Western Commercial Databases. Mm. That presentation got a great deal of interest from very senior level folks throughout the Department of Defense and then the wider government. Mm. And I told a story that was kind of predictive in nature. You know, it was kind of a warning that the advent of several things were going to be of concern to the Air Force. One was the development of personal computers on people's desks. The other was the development of a local area networking technology, which was allowing people at the local level to interconnect those computers readily, and the increasing availability of wide area network technology. So you can interconnect facilities and bases and many, many different computers.
Mm-hmm. So you were warning Air Force leadership about the dangers of personal computers networked together in overlapping networks that include corporate systems and government and military systems, and the probability that not all computer users will always have the best intentions. I mean, basically, you were warning for the first time about attacks through what we would today call the internet. This is something we take for granted as part of life today.
And honestly, back during that day, not many people really understood that.
So you were pretty far ahead of the curve. You were predicting a threat that most people had never thought about. How were you able to see this problem that so many of your peers at the time were unaware of?
I kind of latched onto it because I was a telecom person used to dealing with large-scale transfers of information in the phone network.
Right. So one of the things you did after you published this paper is you traveled around giving talks about the dangers of networked personal computers and wide area networks to various officials and groups in the Air Force. And you eventually came to San Antonio.
A lot of the people who were here in San Antonio at the time in the computer security office were very oriented towards computer operating systems and the vulnerabilities associated with those. Mm-hmm. So I talked about the networking challenges, and the staff down here at the time decided that they needed to address that more aggressively.
Mm. And you must have woken some people up. I mean, you must have rocked the boat. Here were intelligence officers worried about someone at a terminal somehow cracking an operating system, and you're saying, well, no, that bad actor could be cracking your code from anywhere. What happened next?
So that led to a special request for an assignment for me to move down here.
Okay, so the Air Force says, Lee, we need you down here in San Antonio to help figure out how to secure personal computers and computer networks. What were some of the first challenges you faced?
Well, throughout the 70s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, computers were mainframe computers. They were put in rooms with doors and locks and procedures for access. And all of that was changing very rapidly, and the people writing the regulations, like all of us, were new to this networking game. And so we were trying to figure out what to do. And one of the things that we kept wrestling with was we would write policies about how to use personal computers, and surprise, surprise, everyone ignored them.
Right. So while you and other intelligence geeks were wrestling with this kind of abstract problem, something happened that made it a very real and urgent problem. Am I right? What was that?
One day, literally, I think this was, as I remember, it was like a Thursday afternoon. I got a phone call. I've still not told anyone this guy's name, and I know this sounds like something out of a sci-fi or, you know, a spy thriller, but it really happened this way. He said, "Hi, are you Lieutenant Lee Sutterfield?" I said, "Yes, that's me." He said, and his first thing he said was, "What's your mailing address, your official mailing address?" Okay, I'm putting that address on a package, and I'm mailing it directly attention to you.
Wow.
And when it arrives at your office, you need to open it and read it immediately. And I said, "You got my attention. What's this all about?" And he said, "I don't want to explain that over the phone, but I'm just telling you, you need to read this right away." And so I finally got it. And as I was walking back to the office, you know, I tore it open. I was a little impatient, and I started reading the first half of the page. And it was a bunch of not terribly good copies, you know, kind of copiers back in those days weren't all that great. And it was kind of blacked out a little bit and hard to read.
Wow. What did you think this was when you opened it? What did it look like? What did you see?
The first page had a great big convoluted technical title to some kind of a project, and it was occurring at Lawrence Berkeley Labs. So I just started reading a couple of small paragraphs at the bottom, turned the page, read through the second page as I'm walking back to my desk, got to my desk and read the first half of the third page, literally. And I still remember very clearly, I kind of said a little expletive because I was totally surprised. And I said, "This is it. Finally, directed intel over the net."
Now, let me provide a little background on what this means. In the intelligence world, directed intel means spying. Directed, professional, organized, and sophisticated spying, in which a case intelligence officer from a spy agency of another nation recruits various agents and has them actively pursue state secrets or military secrets or other intelligence using deception and illicit methods. In pop culture terms, this is James Bond stuff. What the mysterious anonymous source had provided to Lee was the very thing he'd been warning military leadership about for months, that military systems could be compromised by a bad actor on a personal computer in some other country. In terms of cybersecurity, this was the shot heard around the world. It proved that networked personal computers could be a threat to secret military databases and to government systems. And the document that Lee received was even more interesting. It was not a leaked document from a foreign government or a secret memo from another spy agency. It was notes from an average citizen who had simply stumbled upon an unlikely intruder in his computer system. His name was Clifford Stoll, and he was a very intelligent and resourceful administrator of some computers that were used by astronomers to research astral phenomena. And Cliff had stumbled upon a spy in his computer system, and instead of immediately kicking him out of the system, Cliff waited. He waited and watched and monitored the spy to see what he was doing. Cliff felt a responsibility, in fact, to follow the intruder because he wanted to catch him. Simply shutting him out of the Berkeley computer system would make the intruder just move on to attacking someone else's system. Cliff realized that he had a duty to try and catch this intruder if he could, because if he didn't, he was just passing the problem on to someone else. At first, Cliff thought the hacker must be a bored college student having some fun, just seeing what systems he could access, what digital walls he could get past. But then some weird things happened. Cliff realized that the intruder was very careful about covering his tracks, and very oddly methodical in his approach. Not only that, but this intruder was using Cliff's system and network as a springboard to accessing other computers around the country. Some of those were military computers. Whenever he followed the intruder to a new system, Cliff diligently reached out to the system admin to let him know about the attack. Surprisingly, most of the admins weren't that interested in the threat. Mostly, they cut off access to the intruder and never gave it a second thought. And that's when the Air Force comes in. One of the attacks that Cliff discovered had to do with a classified system that eventually did succeed in raising some eyebrows and lead to the mysterious envelope that Lee received in the mail. I'll let Lee tell more of the story of opening up the mysterious package and beginning to pore through the documents inside.
I read through it and I started taking copious notes, and it turned out that Cliff stole. He still didn't know where the origin of the hackers were from. He had a great deal of detail that he was tracking. He was quite the innovative fellow. I mean, he was begging, borrowing, stealing computers in Warrensburg Labs and setting up monitoring connections and monitoring them all on his own. I mean, it's really a really sophisticated piece of work, especially in that day. And he was trying to figure out what was going on.
So this spy was accessing the computer systems in this astronomy laboratory remotely, then using their network to connect back out to systems all over the country. 408 systems attacked in all. Some of them private companies, some of them military, maybe government. Some of those details were blacked out on the document Lee first saw, and to Lee's knowledge, still classified today. And here's the thing. No one in the NSA and no one in the military had caught on. The only reason anyone was aware of this spy was because of an astronomer in the Bay Area. Noticed a small glitch in a computer accounting program, a clue, and he tracked that clue relentlessly until it led him to the conclusion that someone was in his network who shouldn't be there, that this someone knew how to cover their tracks, and that this someone was methodically and carefully pursuing some unknown goal. Cliff followed this hacker around the country as he broke into different computer systems, but the one thing he couldn't figure out is who this guy was and what he wanted. That's where Lee comes back into the story. Lee notices something in Cliff's notes that allows Air Force intelligence to begin to locate the spy.
Now, at the stage in which we had the notes, this was another significant thing, he was trying to figure out what was going on, where it was coming from. He had no clue.
Right.
And he had noted a delay between the time between the command that he saw online and the next command. Was a very consistent time frame. I forget what it was, you know, 40 seconds or something. And as soon as I read that, because of other things I had done in the intelligence community, I was pretty sure I knew exactly what was going on. I figured that this was, first of all, by the behavior, it was directed intel, which means a case officer was directing hackers somewhere to go gather this particular information.
Wow. So,
and then the other thing was they were not likely in Asia for a number of reasons, but the delay wasn't long enough, especially back in that day. But the delay, as a combat ground guy, I knew was probably appropriate for somewhere in Europe.
Wow. Remember, we're talking about an era when the only way to connect was through dial-up modems over the phone lines. And these phone lines were analog. It took real time for a signal sent over the lines to go through miles of cable and switches. The longer the delay, the longer the distance. Lee puts two and two together and realizes this hacker isn't a bored teen in his mother's garage in San Francisco. This is an agent in Europe. Europe means Eastern Europe, and Eastern Europe means Soviet bloc. And don't forget, this is the Cold War. This is a time in the early 80s when the threat of nuclear war with Russia is still very, very real. So Lee puts this assertion into his report. Some spy based in Europe, probably Bulgaria, is using a personal computer and a series of civilian network connections to attack military systems in the US. And, up until now, no one had the slightest hint this was happening. This leads to a sea change in the Air Force's approach to computer security that can be viewed as the birth of modern cybersecurity efforts. It is no longer enough to write policies about what people should and shouldn't do on their personal computers. Now there needs to be new policies around networking and ways to detect threats and vulnerabilities before they're a problem. Essentially, cybersecurity is now an active discipline, and Lee and his team first assert that we need good guys combing through the networks proactively looking for bad actors, vulnerabilities, problems, and challenges.
We postulated a different approach. And the idea was very simple. Conceptually, is that, first of all, don't write a policy if you can't enforce it. Mm-hmm. And if you can't see bad behavior, you can't enforce anything. So you had to have rules against it, policy, and you had to have an ability to enforce that policy.
Right.
That may not sound all that radical, but back then it was radical. And so that inferred that you had to have some visibility and control over cyberspace.
Right.
Somebody needed to walk those digital hallways and rattle those binary knobs, right? Mm-hmm. Just like a security person does inside a building, you need to do that inside your corner of cyberspace, whatever that is.
Uh-huh. Active cybersecurity patrolling. Detection, enforcement, counterintelligence, protection. Some of the key concepts behind modern cybersecurity. Like so many things, the problem that almost no one could see at the time is completely obvious in hindsight. First, we invent computers to handle information. Then, because they are so powerful, we use them to store and manage some of our most important data, military weapons design, state communications, and so on. Then we create computers that can talk to each other. First, it's a few computers in the same room. Then we create a way for computers to connect remotely. Then we create personal computers, which leads to more computers in the world and more people on computers, and more remote connections and more networks, and each network can talk to each other. Cyberspace is not founded on any concept of national borders or enemy lines. A Soviet spy would need to do a lot of very difficult things in the early 80s to sneak into the US and get onto a military base in Georgia. But it turns out it wasn't all that hard for a hacker to do so from his personal computer in his bedroom in Europe. The story of Cliff Stull and the hacker he discovered is told in Cliff's book, The Cuckoo's Egg, and is known in the intelligence world as the Hanover Hacker Case. Let's listen to Lee tell us how that story ended.
I'll make a long story short. Ultimately found out that that group was in fact a directed intel operation, directed officially by the Bulgarian Secret Service. They had recruited three German citizens, lived around Hanover, hence the Hanover Hacker. And there was a court case where they were prosecuted. Two of them were prosecuted because prior to the court case, one of them was found in the Black Forest burned alive. He was burned alive with gasoline poured over him and burned to death.
That's it for this first episode of Speaking of Security, the cybersecurity and voice security podcast from SecureLogix. Thank you to Lee Sutterfield for being with us today.
It's been great fun.
And thank you, Lee, for that fascinating story and glimpse into the past of cybersecurity history. This podcast was produced by Lightning Jar and brought to you by SecureLogix, the world leader in call authentication and security, protecting contact centers, businesses, and a wide range of government, municipal, and private voice networks from cyber threats, including TDoS attacks, fraud, robocalls, and other abuse. You can find them online at SecureLogix.com, that's logic spelled L-O-G-I-X, or speak directly to one of their voice security experts by calling 210-402-9669. Again, that's 210-402-9669.